To First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yoes, your host. Coming up a little bit later in the second hour, Iori Odigizua, my producer, my right hand, is going to be taking over the show. She is speaking to ABC News Entertainment producer Joy Marie McKenzie about her new book, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage and I Do to Me. That is going to be a fascinating conversation. You want to stick around for that when Iori takes over the back end of the show. But before we get to Iori, Pia Jordan is in the studio. Pia Jordan is project director of the Tuskegee Army Nurses. Keep them flying. She's also assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Professor Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And if I could take a liberty, Iori was one of my former students, your producer.
Well, then you did a great job.
You did a great job.
Absolutely. Yes, you did a great job. So that is somebody you should hold up as one of your former students, because she's done great work here on First Edition and here at WEAA. But you are here because you have a really fascinating, a beautiful exhibit called Keep 'Em Flying. It is about the Tuskegee Army Nurses, and dispel what people may think about. People may automatically think that they are connected to the Tuskegee Airmen, but they are not really, right?
Yes, they are.
They are.
I got it all wrong. What it is, they were the nurses.
They weren't trained at Tuskegee Institute.
They weren't trained at Tuskegee Institute. Because sometimes people mistake them, because the nurses I've interviewed, they were trained in other nursing schools around the country.
Right.
But the thing is, the nurses were officers in the Army Nurse Corps. The Tuskegee Airmen phrase was not coined until the 1950s.
Okay.
So this is the 1940s. And so these were cadets, pilot cadets. And I guess most of us know the story that they were trying to prove that African-American men were smart enough to fly planes.
Right, right.
And so they separated them, had their own air base. And these nurses were stationed at what was then Tuskegee Army Airfield. And this is where the later airmen did their advanced training. But they had to salute the nurses
because
they had no rank.
Right.
And the nurses were officers.
Wow. Well, so how did... First of all, let's be clear. Your mom was one of these nurses.
Yes, my mother was one of the nurses.
Wow.
What happened is how I even got started on this project, and what I'm finding out about a lot of the children of the Tuskegee Airmen and the nurses, our parents never really talked a whole lot about it.
Yeah, that's stoic generation.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It's like occasionally I would see my mother's uniform in one of those big suitcases called. And I think I saw her scrapbook once, but what happened is she had several strokes, and I'm her only child. And I started looking through her things, and I'm going, oh my goodness, this scrapbook has Tuskegee Army Flying School on the outside. And there were these pictures of Tuskegee Airmen and nurses, and I'm going, oh my goodness, my mother's a Tuskegee Airman nurse. And I said, a couple years later, I started at Morgan. And I'm saying, gee, I wish I had done, I'm a journalist, I wish I had done something with this years ago. And one of my colleagues said, well, you know, why don't you start? So what I did, and we agreed, the first thing, I had to get on doing interviews with them because they're dying out.
Of course.
And so that's what I got on a plane. One of the nurses was in California. One nurse was in New Jersey at that time. She's now in Atlanta. I couldn't find the rest of them, although one family member called me to say her grandmother was living with her, and I said she was one of the nurses, but she wasn't in condition to talk to me at that time, and so I didn't get any more information about her until the family told me she had died in December.
Wow. So where do we begin? What a fascinating story. Let's talk about first how they came together. I mean, whose idea was it to bring these women together to form this unit?
Well, the Army Nurse Corps was black and white. But what happened is there was a quota on the number of nurses. Now, the Army Nurse Corps, to be in the Army Nurse Corps, the Red Cross was the recruiting arm of the Army Nurse Corps. So you had to have been a member of the Red Cross.
Let me ask a question that seems obvious to me, but one that is kind of a, in my mind, a trifling question in a way. But were there black Army nurses because only black Army nurses could work on black soldiers?
Basically.
Of course.
So
couldn't have a white woman working on a black man.
And I don't, as one airman told me, he felt good that there were women there who, if something happened to him, they would really care about him.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, to be in the Army Nurse Corps, you had to have been a member of the American Red Cross. You had to have finished nursing school. Mm-hmm. These were all graduates of nursing school.
Right.
You had to be a registered nurse. So these were all RNs. And you had to be a member of a national nursing organization. Now, that was difficult for some of these women because the nursing associations were white.
Right.
But there was the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses who stepped in to take that role.
Mm-hmm.
So these were women from all over the country. They'd gone to schools in different states.
Mm-hmm.
They were different ages. Some of them, like my mother and two of her schoolmates, they all graduated different years, but they were there. And then the other women, they were from the Midwest, the North, and the South,
mm-hmm.
pretty much. And so they were in the Army Nurse Corps. They were military, but the thing is, they didn't take as many black nurses as they took white nurses. There were about, once the World War II started, about 500 black nurses,
mm-hmm.
and what was it, 50,000? I have my little notes here. 50,000 Army Nurse Corps nurses, and 500 of them
out
were black.
Out of 50,000, only 500 were black?
Right.
Wow.
There was that quota. They weren't going to
wow.
let any more. And then, too, they not only had to deal with racism, they had to deal with sexism.
Of course.
You know, the military back then, they didn't want any women practically to come out, but they needed the nurses because there was even like a quota for even the white nurses. But once World War II, you know, started, they needed the nurses
mm-hmm.
to fill in the positions.
Mm-hmm. Man, thank God for these women because many of them really created the pathway, blazed the trail for my mother and others like my mother who was a registered nurse and went to nursing school and did all the things that you just described. So I didn't even think about the fact that she was treading on difficult ground, you know what I mean?
Right, because what happened, I did do an exhibit and I spoke at the Tuskegee Airmen Convention in 2011, and that was the year my mother died. And one military nurse came up to my exhibit. And she was looking, because I have a virtual scrapbook,
mm-hmm.
and she was almost in tears,
mm-hmm.
and she was saying, these women are the ones who laid a foundation for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. We're in the second hour on this Tuesday in the studio with Pia Jordan. She's project director of the Tuskegee Army Nurses. Keep them flying. She's also assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Let's talk about these women. And why don't we start with your mother, of course.
Okay. My mother grew up in Nottoway County, Virginia. So
what county?
Nottoway County, Virginia. It's
all
like
right.
Crewe, Virginia, if anybody's Nottoway. Familiar with it.
Nottoway, you got to get a way out of Nottoway.
Right,
Nottoway.
Right.
There's not a way out, but you got to. She got to.
Yeah. Actually, I think there was a movie. I saw one of the movies. I'm not sure which one, if it was, which one was one of the recent ones, slave movies.
Oh, okay.
And one of the masters said, well, I'm my farm or something is down in Nottoway County.
Well,
and I was laughing. I'm going, oh my goodness.
It's probably a Birth of a Nation in that tournament.
Yes, I think it was Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
And so I'm going, wow. Because there are stories that my mother told me about living in Nottoway County, which weren't very pleasant. So anyway, my mother told me that she really respected the doctor in the community. And I guess he was the only African-American doctor
mm-hmm.
to handle all the black patients. And she really respected him, and she wanted to go to nursing school. Now, her grandfather was a Presbyterian minister, and he sent all his grandchildren, his older grandchildren, to boarding school, boarding high school. So after she finished school, this was pretty much her next step, to join the Tuskegee Army, well, to join the Army Nurse Corps. And I read a letter that she received from the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses. It was saying, I'm sorry you're having, Miss Lomax, because that was her maiden name, having so much trouble getting into the Army Nurse Corps. We're going to pass this, your letter on to. And then I think it was just a couple months later in 1943, she was at Tuskegee Army Airfield.
It was incredible foresight on her grandfather's behalf to make sure all his grandchildren went to that those boarding high schools, because in many cases, if you were black in certain far away, not away counties and like and the like, you wouldn't have the opportunity to go to high school.
And the Presbyterian Church was usually good making sure that children were getting educated. But let me add this. He made sure his grandchildren, his daughters, they weren't educated.
Oh, wow.
But he had the grandchildren. They were educated. Well,
that's an interesting thing.
That's another story.
That is another story. That is another story. But so once she, when did she begin the training? When did?
So March 1943, she got to Tuskegee. Now, when they were on the base, nurses had basic training, but it wasn't like the men going into the Army Nurse Corps, because they were nurses. Right. They were there. They were professional women who had a role to play. They had to do, every month, a 10-mile hike. They had to learn how to use gas masks. And I have some pictures in my mother's scrapbook with them with their gas masks on. So pretty much their role was to be at the station hospital to not only help with the pilot cadets, but the families who were there, other military personnel. So that was the main hospital on that base. And keep in mind, here you have African Americans in a town, Tuskegee, Alabama, who they didn't really want them there. But can you imagine having African Americans with guns in your town and you don't want them there anyway? Wow. That was
a volatile kind of combination.
Yes.
Yeah. And no doubt about it. So once you start digging into these photos and these archives and these narratives, what was your take? I mean, your mind must have been blown.
Goodness. I went to the University of California at Riverside. They have an archive. The Air Force has an archive. Well, the University of California is in California. The Air Force has an archive, Maxwell Air Force Base, which is the suppository of and was kind of overseeing Tuskegee in the 40s. So I went to them. I went to the National Archive 1 and 2, D.C., and in College Park. I went through all their hospital rosters. You know, they had little magazines on the base where I got information about what some of the nurses were doing. And then I interviewed airmen who knew the nurses. Now, if I can give you one story.
Of course.
One man, unfortunately, a few months after I interviewed him, he died. But his last name was Goodall. And so he was a pilot. And so I asked him, well, did he remember the nurses? And so what he did, I gave him the scrapbook. And he saw my mother's picture, and he started laughing. And when he had the mumps, she was his nurse.
Wow.
Then I even called Switzerland. There's a conductor in Switzerland. And unfortunately, he, what they call, I guess, washed out. He didn't finish, but he was a musician and played an instrument. So I found him. I was able to get his number, and I called him. And I sent my mother's picture through his son to him. But he laughed because he got one of the nurses, he said, in a corner, and was about to kiss her.
Oh.
And she said, the nurse said something like, you know, I'm an officer, or, you know, cadet so-and-so, you know, what are you doing? And he said, it was my mother. And so I was really, I said, once I asked my mother, why didn't she marry one of the Tuskegee Airmen? Because some of the nurses did marry the airmen. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed a couple of the women who were the spouses. Mm-hmm. But she said she wasn't serious enough. So.
Okay.
But let me tell you what also Pilot Goodall said, and I took it wrong at first.
Okay.
He said, oh, your mother was fast. She was just fast. And I'm going,
wait,
I asked my mother.
About my mama,
I know.
Boy.
I said, I went to my mother, and I said, Mom, the pilot said you were fast. She said, I was quick. I wanted to get my work done, so I tended to do things fast.
Oh, you knew so, that was it. That had to have been it.
Yeah, because I'm going, yeah, this doesn't sound like my mother. Mama. But anyway, what, she was in her 20s then. So.
No. She was very, she was moved with a
That's
lot
right.
of speed,
this Presbyterian,
alacrity.
That's right. Granddaughter.
Right. But so what about some, I mean, these photos, I mean, I can't get enough of photos like this anyway, but.
Well, two of them I know are living.
Really?
And I've
really?
Interviewed both of them. And one of them, believe she'll be 101 or 102 in August.
Mm.
She was married to one of the airmen who was in the first group. Now, many people may know B.O. Davis, General B.O.
Right,
Davis.
Benjamin O. Davis, yeah.
That he and four others were in the first group of Tuskegee Airmen to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
She was married to one of them, who was named Mac Ross. Unfortunately, he died overseas.
Mm.
And then another one, Irma Dryden, she married Airman Charles Dryden, who wrote a book, The A-Train, The Story of the Tuskegee Airmen. And unfortunately, after 30-some years of marriage, they divorced. But they met, and I have a PowerPoint display where I include her interview. The night she got to Tuskegee, there were three nurses who traveled by train. Now, understand, too, they were from New York, and once you got to D.C., it was segregated. The blacks had to go
right.
back. So she said she was so incensed that she refused to eat when she had to leave because of her race, and they were in the military going down south. So when she got there, she said she was so tired, and all she wanted to do was rest. But the principal chief nurse, who was Della Rainey, now Della Rainey was the first African-American woman in the Army Nurse Corps, and she was their principal chief nurse. She told her that that was not a request. It was an order that you were to go and see off one of the squadron who were going to be leaving the base.
Mm-hmm.
So she went, she met Charles Dryden, and actually they kind of lost track of each other. He lost her number or how to get in touch with her. So the principal chief nurse had to play like Cupid so they would get together, and they got married. And she said that coming down there changed her life.
Well, you know, you just mentioned an incident of segregation and racism that they had to endure probably on a regular, regular basis, these indignities that these beautiful black women and men had to endure while serving their country. Incredibly patriotic people, yet that racism, that overt racism that they found, or rather they had to endure, or they had that was right in their face. It didn't deter them from being the outstanding American patriots that they actually were.
Right. And there were incidents.
Of course.
And one of the commanders there, some of them were rather racist, but the one they really respected, he would make sure when there were incidents to keep everybody on base, to try to, I guess, be a go-between between the town and the base. Now, the base is now owned by a family, a lumber company.
Really?
And what they've done, they've cleared off the place, the sons have cleared off the area where the base was, because there are still curbs.
Mm.
Lena Horne Way, a
wow.
sign there. They put up a flagpole, and their trees, they're planting around the base.
Oh.
And they put up this gate that says Tuskegee Army
oh,
Flying School. Now, this is a white family.
Well, that's
and
beautiful.
I interviewed him, and I asked him, why are you all doing this? He said he told his father the significance of this property. Unfortunately, the Army sold it.
Hmm.
So the National Historic Site for the Tuskegee Airmen, it's their beginning training site. Moton Field, which is named after one of the Tuskegee Institute's presidents. Mm-hmm. I've been on that base a couple of times, and you can see still some smokestacks. But once I went by myself just to drive by it, because you know it's like red clay, mm-hmm. the road mm-hmm. leading past mm-hmm. it, and I don't know, I felt this like fear. Just driving by it, I don't know. I'm saying, am I experiencing what they felt as when they were on the base? They had their own little town there. Mm. You know, there was their own little community.
And this family has preserved that community at least somewhat.
Infrastructure. And even when they opened up the National Park Service's Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site. They had them come, the airmen come. They had put up a flagpole where the administration building would have been, mm-hmm. and they came to the actual base. And I know that must have meant a lot to them to have gone to the base.
So how can people find this exhibit online? Give us all the details of how to do that.
All right. I have a website. It's www.tuskegee, spelled TUSKEGEE. armynurses.info. I have a phone number. You can call 855-823-7262. And if you're so inclined, I even have a post office box in Tuskegee Institute, Alabama.
Okay.
Because the first group, the 99th, is post office box 99, Tuskegee Institute, Alabama, 36087. But the best way is all that information is on the website, TuskegeeArmyNurses.info, INFO.
Let me end the segment by reading this quote from Louise V. Lomax Winters, who was one of the nurses.
That's my mother.
That's your mom's. Okay. She says, quote, many times during that period, nurses were saying, I regret that I have only one life to give to my country. We were very patriotic during that time. No one had to beg us to go into the service. No one had to beg the young men. Young men were glad to go into the service. They wore their uniform proudly. That is Louise V. Lomax Winters. She is the mama of
former Lieutenant Lomax.
Former Lieutenant Lomax, mother of Pia Jordan, who is the project director of the Tuskegee Army Nurses. Keep them flying. Also assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Pia Jordan, such a pleasure to meet you and for you to share this beautiful exhibit with us. We appreciate you so much.
And thank you for having me. It's getting the word out.
Of course, of course. All right. I'm about to get out of the chair. Iorio Digizu is about to take over First Edition, so stay tuned for that. Her interview with ABC News entertainment producer Joy Marie McKenzie is next. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to First Edition on this Tuesday evening. I'm your host, Iorio Digizua, producer of the show, sitting in for Sean Yost. Support for WEAA is provided by Kidda. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition. Also, connect with Sean on his personal Twitter account, tag at First Edition, and Facebook page, Sean Yost, with info, insight, and breaking news. We wind down this Tuesday evening with a woman who is so much more amazing in person than her resume, and her resume is extremely impressive. Entertainment producer for ABC News, covering television, film, and music for several platforms. I'm talking about none other than Joy Marie McKenzie, creator of The Fab Empire, an award-winning website that covers celebrities, society, and local events in cities across the United States. Joy Marie, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to First Edition.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here, my hometown, so feels great.
Yes, Baltimore in the house.
Yes.
So you have a new book. It is called The engagement game. Yes. Why I said I don't to marriage and I do to me. I want to get into that book because it really is a page turner. As I was reading, I'm just like, oh my goodness. But first, I do want to take a few minutes to recognize the work that you do.
Yes.
As I stated, you're a producer and writer. Did you always know that you wanted to work on this side of entertainment? And how does it feel to be on the other side of the mic?
I hate it. I'll answer that question first. I hate being interviewed because I'm used to being in control of the conversation. And like, I know what I'm saying. So it's very weird to get used to, but I'm enjoying it so far with you. I always knew that I would be, if I was going to be a journalist, I would be an entertainment journalist because I watched my grandmother, Ida Murphy Peters. She was an entertainment editor until the very day that she died. And so I watched her growing up, sit at her typewriter, go out to events. She took me to my first concert, the Immature concert, downtown Baltimore.
Okay.
I went with her. You know, she would hand me like CDs of Monica and Chris Brown and all these people like, oh yeah, just, you know, listen to these and see if you like them. Mm-hmm. So I grew up around entertainment and just being interested in it. So I feel like my stars were sort of set with her. Mm. Thanks to my grandmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So in a way, your career, you kind of pay homage to her, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think so. I feel her spirit all the time, and people tell me all the time, like, you know, my grandmother's watching over me. So I feel like I'm living out a lot of what she wanted to do.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now, you've interviewed names from actor TV host Cannon to actress Yawa Shahidi, who's the oldest sister in Black-ish.
Yes.
What does it mean to be responsible to have conversations with celebrities and highlight the positive natures of them in their work?
Right. Yeah. I always say, you know, because I have to work with publicists and they're like, please don't ask this. And I always say, I'm not a gotcha reporter. I'm not trying to be salacious. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's enough of that. And so I try to provide an opportunity for people to be themselves and to share with them. I love to learn from celebrities what makes them who they are and how they got there, how they've become successful.
Mm-hmm.
So my series right now on abcnews.com is like Celeb 101. We just talked to 50 Cent earlier this week.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I'm just asking him, like, you know, how did you get to be 50 Cent? Like people don't really know how they got there. You know, we see the bumper sticker mottos and all that. But, like, what was it in your mindset, in your personhood that made you be the successful person? And so that's what I'm most interested in learning from celebrities and trying to get people to see that they are real people.
Okay, very good. So, all right, now let's get into the book, The Engagement Game, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage and I Do to Me. So I want to read some of the reviews.
Okay.
Amazing reviews. The columnist of the Washington Post says your book is, quote, freaking hilarious and sometime cringe-inducing time machine.
Mm-hmm.
Black voice editor of the Huffington Post calls it a compelling tale. This journey provides her with an important life lesson on how to remain true to self while seeking marriage. Now, this one was my favorite. From staff editor of People Magazine.
Oh, yes.
In an age where looking for love means field mendering and advances made over DM and swiping aimlessly through apps and online profiles. First of all, the description was just amazing.
That's very true. Yes.
So, I mean, you have reviews that speak so much volume to your writing ability and your storytelling ability. Talk to us about that.
They're all very gracious. I'm glad that you read the positive ones. But, you know, I honestly can't believe it. You know, when I, you know, sent the book out for the first time, that was the first time that I had to even have other people read it were the critics.
Mm.
So that was very scary. So I was just praying the whole time, like, please let them like it. But yeah, I'm thankful that they liked it. Yeah, and that they could relate. Because a lot of the time I was writing it, I'm like, are people going to think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
You know, and I always say this book is not anti-marriage. It's just anti-marrying the wrong person.
Right.
And so I felt like, you know, they got it.
Yeah. And I think some of the reviews reflected that for some of the ladies who aren't necessarily in their 20s like us, that they could go back and look to when they were in that time frame, whether or not you're a millennial or you're in the new age of social media. It was like, this happened for all of us.
Yes. And I did not know that. I really felt like I was alone, like I was going to be deemed crazy. So it really feels great that this book is out and people are like, yes, I've been in that situation. Or I've dated a guy for 5 years, or I've dated a guy for 7 years and lived with him. So it just feels good that there is this sort of community and, you know, creating a safe space for people to talk about this stuff.
That's one of my favorite quotes. There's nothing new under the sun. You never know. Now let's jump right into the book. In the first paragraph, literally the first couple of lines, like I said, it's promising to be a page turner. You describe what you thought was going to be a proposal to your then boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about, talk us through the anxiety that you went through and that you felt that night.
Right. So I was at, it was, you know, New Year's Eve. You know, that's traditionally a very excited time, and we're at a club, we're at one of our favorite clubs in DC, and you know, he's sitting next to me looking in into my eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, Joy, you're going to be my wife one day. I mean, wouldn't you think that's
absolutely
a start of a proposal?
Absolutely.
And we'd already talked about it, we'd already talked about rings, we talked about what our kids would look like, we had sort of had all the conversations that I felt. So I was like, oh my gosh, he's proposing. And so I'm looking at his hands like, okay, are his hands going to go to his pockets? Like, is he going to go down on one knee? And then he like stands up. And I'm like, I don't understand.
That's not what's supposed to happen.
No. So then I was like, okay, well, we'll just go home. You know, I just sort of played it off, but I definitely thought I was going to get proposed to, but I didn't. So that sort of started me down this path of craziness to get the ring, which is what the book is about.
Get the ring.
Yeah.
Have to get the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the author's note, you state that the names were changed, obviously, for the privacy of friends and family.
To protect them.
Exactly. And just wanted to lay that out there to our listeners before we dig into the book a bit more. You mentioned that you told your older sister about what happened, the maybe proposal or the
pseudo proposal.
The pseudo proposal.
Yes.
Had your family met him at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Or given approval of acceptance?
Yeah, I mean, we at this point, we were together for 5 years.
Okay.
So we had done everything. We had done the holidays. We had done the barbecues, the christenings, the baby showers, the weddings.
All the important events that they're supposed to be at.
Yeah, our lives were blended. I knew his family. And so, you know, we were in it, I thought, to win it. Mm. But no, we weren't. So, yeah, we had done it. Yeah, I was telling him, I don't need to get to know you anymore. I know you.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to continue dating.
Right. We don't need to figure this out. If it's figured out at this point, let's just do what's next.
I thought, exactly. But that did not happen.
Now, if you're just joining us, you're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. I'm Eorio Digizilla, producer of the show, sitting in for Sean Yeos, as we speak with writer and producer of ABC News and author of her new book, The Engagement Game, Why I Said I Do to Marriage.
I don't to marriage. Yes.
And I do to me. Let's get that right. This is Joy Marie McKenzie. Now, maybe 20-somethings like us would kill for a career like yours, for the friendships that you have, the amazing apartment that you have, the living, lifestyle that you have.
Yes.
But you were still ready to check off the marriage or the husband box.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah. I feel like I was 28 when I wrote this book, so I'm 31 now. So I do see a lot differently. But at that time, I felt like, okay, I've done everything that they have told me, you know, I've done everything that they told me to do. I went to college, you know, got good grades, I graduated. I found a job like they tell you to do. I moved to the city where I've always wanted to live. I got a great job. I have great friends, family. And so it's like, you feel like this is the last piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. You know, I have it all together. Why not me? And at the time, I was going through this spiral of, you know, he's telling me, yes, we're going to get married. So I'm watching Say Yes to the Dress. I'm following, you know, the wedding things on Instagram. I'm all in it, you know, sort of planning my life, not realizing that this was not what God had for me, mm-hmm. you know. But either way, you know, so I go to my older sister and I ask her, so what do I do to get proposed to? Like, I'm doing something wrong, because I had never, I'm like, is there like something I need to do mm-hmm. besides just existing?
And she was experienced.
Yeah, she was married. She was pregnant at the time. And she says, yeah, well, you know, why don't you play the game? You know, and so she gives me sort of tips to sort of better prepare myself.
Mm.
Now, I should have known it was going to be some mess when she was saying, oh, it's going to be easy. But, you know, there were things that actually made a lot of sense. So, like, the first thing was make a list of what you want in a husband.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of ask yourself, what do you see? Or, like,
I'm
what do you
see? Pause there. Let our listeners listen. Make that list, ladies.
Yes.
Men too. You really should know what you want.
Yeah. Clarify what you want, because at 28 years old, 5 years into a relationship, I never asked myself what I wanted in a partner, which sounds crazy. Mm. And so she said, you know, write a list down. And I did. I thought about it. And it was, you know, it wasn't wasn't things like, oh, he must drive this sort of car. It was, you know, I need a man with integrity. He has mm-hmm. to be God-fearing, mm-hmm. you know, a college degree, things like that. So just general things that any respectable man would have. And then she would tell me, you know, keep yourself up. I'm like, okay, I need to do that for my job done. You know, she also suggested to date yourself, which was a concept new to me that I did not want to do. I'm like, no, I don't want to date myself. I'm with myself all the time. I don't need any more time with myself. But she noticed that, you know, there were things, there were hobbies and interests and desires that I wasn't fostering because I didn't have a partner to do it with. Mm-hmm. And so I would be begging him, oh, can I, let's please go biking in Central Park. And she's like, just go by yourself,
yeah.
you know, and like, why deny yourself that pleasure? Because you don't have someone to do it with.
Yeah.
And so I began to date myself. I took myself to this movie that no one wanted to go with me to see, which I read about in the book, which is really funny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mm-hmm. biked in Central Park. So I did all these things that sort of filled me up and that made me feel better, you know.
Now you're talking my language.
Yeah.
I do that on a regular.
Oh, do you?
Yes. I love it. Because
it's so scary for me.
I think amongst me and my friends, that is, we're very kind of not as artsy or kind yeah. of creative, and I am. And so mm-hmm. when I was like, I want to see this play or this opera, they're like, what?
No.
Like, nah, girl, bye, girl. So I started going by myself until I got around other people who had the same interests.
Exactly.
And then my friends were like, oh, well, maybe I'll go.
Exactly.
And it actually broadened their horizon, too.
Nice. But I think yeah. that's part of the point. It's like, you know, when you do things that you like, you find other people there that like doing it too, and then
exactly.
you make new friendships and new relationships. So
exactly.
it all, you know, it was all great advice. There was one sort of crazy advice
uh-oh,
that I read about
uh-oh.
In the book was she told me to cook engagement chicken.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember. I read it.
And so for those of you who have never heard of engagement chicken, it is this concept that you cook a bird with lemon and spices, and it's supposed to make your man magically propose to you. I thought it was stupid. I think it still is stupid, but I did try it, but I can't cook, so it didn't turn out
well. And you talk about that. See, I don't want to get into that, but you talk about that in the book, how he was kind of considered the better cook.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He was a great cook. He knew how to, like, you know, cook lobsters. I don't know how to do that. I can barely cook rice. So cooking does not like me. It does not have my address.
But at least you're honest to your truth. That
yeah, I can't cook. And
yeah.
I don't want to cook. And you know, now I'm with a guy, he doesn't care.
I'm
like, I'm going to order the best food for yeah. us to eat. You know, so yeah.
I know, that's right.
Yeah, I can't.
If you don't mind, I want to read a few excerpts from the book.
Sure. Yeah.
So this was... Okay, let's see. Now, Lindsay and Lamar were getting married, and I still wasn't. And now, I really didn't want to get out of bed. Talk about who Lindsay and Lamar are. I think there were a couple that had a younger age on their relationship than
yep.
you,
yep.
Who met after you met your then boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Yeah. It's sort of that feeling that, you know, I was comparing myself to everybody around me. So I would be looking at other people's relationships and comparing them and saying, okay, are they happier than we are? Like, am I in the right place? And so Lindsay and Lamar, they're my dear friends. We were just, me and my new man, we were with them last weekend. They're great. And so they got engaged after 2 years. And here I am 5 years in. You know, I was there when she met him. You know, we were at this house party. And it just seemed like, what? How are they getting engaged quicker than me and my ex? So
that's not fair. Like,
yeah,
I
just felt like
more time.
Like, what am I?
Yeah.
Really, I felt like, what am I doing wrong? Am I doing something wrong? And I was trying to figure out the problem, like trying to correct it. Like, if I'm not doing something, because I feel like the reality is that especially for Black women, we don't really talk about the engagement process.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this mystical
mm-hmm.
thing that you're mm-hmm. just supposed to know how to do, or you're supposed to know when you're ready. And you're supposed to know how to enter marriage. I don't know.
I can agree with that.
And,
yep.
you know, instead, and I, you know, I have to be gentle with myself now, but, you know, instead of going to my mom, I go to my older sister. You know, it's like, instead of going to your elders, you sort of go to your friends, the people in your peer group, and you're like, okay, well, what did you do? And let's try to figure this out together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like, yeah, it just, yeah, that's
yeah.
what I was.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because I think it's maybe the lack of community sometimes.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe
if it's
the lack.
I think it's a bit of culture, honestly.
Okay. Yeah.
Because every culture does it, you know, does marriage differently.
Right.
The Indian community is completely different than the Asian
right.
community. So I feel like, you know, for African American community, I think there is this sort of, I like to call it like, it's like the silence of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
People that are married, they keep all of their business to themselves. That's what we're taught, right? Like, you keep this is our relationship between you and I.
That don't work for me. Well, I'm super inquisitive. Like, I ask questions. Right. I have a lot of friends that are married
now. Right, but the problem is, we don't feel comfortable going to those married couples and are like, well, am I doing this right? Like, what should I? And so we're left to figure it out by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that is especially true for the engagement process. I think a lot of times people won't tell you what they really did to get it until after you've gotten it. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, really, for real, girl, I did this. And you're like, oh, for real?
Well, first of all, after you opened up and said what you did, it's like, well, I guess me too.
Yeah, and it's like, but you know,
so there needs to be more transparency. Yeah, more transparency, and more kind of just genuine, like something that people can relate to.
Right. I think also too, especially for Black women now, we are pushed to succeed. You know, because our foremothers didn't have those opportunities. And so when I was growing up, I didn't hear anything about, oh yeah, grow up to find a good husband. I know, and that's different in the African community. I know that because I have a lot of friends who are Nigerian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but when they're little, that's what their foremothers tell them, like, grow up and find a good husband. No, that I never heard that. Mm-hmm. It was grow up, be the best you can be, succeed, succeed, succeed. But the problem with that is that we succeed and then we're, 30-something years old looking like, okay, well, where's my husband? How do I start a family? Because we weren't taught that. We weren't even taught to want that, to desire that. Like, why do you want a man?
And in a lot of African-American households where women are taught to be independent anyway. Yeah. Independent and kind of career-driven. And
you can misconstrue that.
Yep.
And then wake up and be like, oh, crap, I need to find a man.
Right. Because I think it's important to talk about if, in fact, you want to be married.
Yes.
Let's talk, have that conversation with your children. Not necessarily drilling it into them like, oh, you're getting old and your egg. You know, don't have that conversation. But that's definitely rude. Kind of, right. But you, girl, you'd be surprised.
Oh, I've heard.
Oh, yes. Yes, I have. Yeah. Okay. But I see what you're saying. Yeah. I definitely see what you're saying.
I think we should have more of those conversations once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. That's important.
Yeah.
Now, I love the way that you describe how you met and who you've named in the book at.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who was your then boyfriend? You asked him, you guys were at a party, you guys were at a setting, and this is the quote from the book. Okay. Listen, can you get this guy to leave? My friend is coming here at any second, and he's a jealous type. Sure, he says. Where's your boyfriend? My friend, I corrected, is coming out now. Please unravel what all that was about.
Okay, yes. So I'm like, what part of the book? Okay, yeah. So this was when I first met Adam for the very first time. And he was in a club and I saw him and I was like, oh, he's cute. But I was dating someone at the time. Now, I call him my friend because that's all he was. There was no title. There was no nothing. He was just a good friend who I've been on a lot of dates with for years.
Yeah.
But, it was a situationship. And so,
First of all, explain that for all of our listeners.
It's like...
oh, I know what it is.
Okay. It's not a relationship. Okay. We're clear on that. I can't ask you where you are, who you're with. And you can't ask me who I am and who I'm with, but like we talk all the time. Mm-hmm. It's stupid, but that's what I was.
And
saying.
It's clear that maybe you guys like each other.
We like each other. You know, yes.
Okay.
It's just a mess, but that's what I was in for like a long time with this guy, and so he was very jealous though, and so another random guy comes up to me in the club and he's trying to like, or outside of the club rather, and he's trying to run game. And I'm like, oh gosh, if my friend comes out, he is going to lose it because he's very jealous. So I asked Adam, hey, can you please get this guy to leave? Mm-hmm. And instead, Adam bear hugs me and doesn't let me go. And so the friend comes out, looks at me, scowls, and just runs off. I don't hear from him for 3 days. And Adam says, you're welcome. Pretty much saying like, that guy's a loser anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, be done with him. Mm-hmm. And he was right. So it helped. Thank you. Thank you for getting me out of that situation.
But his feelings had to be hurt.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
Why he didn't talk to you for 3 days.
I'm sure. Well, that's what friends do.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever.
Yeah. So you guys aren't friends to this day? Yeah.
Oh, no. That guy is married and has a lovely life. Oh,
okay.
And
that's definitely
later
in the years. Okay, cool. That's interesting. So you met him then, and then things kind of formed from there.
Yes. So we met outside. We met at the let out, and I explained what that is in the book. But it's y'all know what the let out is. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going into the club, but you're at the let out.
Yeah, the let out.
So we met at a let out, and we began dating. And then I guess within a year, we were like, boyfriend and girlfriend. But And then 2 years, we'd already talked about marriage and looking at rings and all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
So imagine my frustration at year 5.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That was taunting. Why did he do that?
See, I don't know. And a lot of people are like, do you think he led you on?
I mean.
But see, I don't think that he did. I honestly don't think that he did. I think that what we did wrong, looking back, is that we never had a formal conversation about how we foresaw this relationship going, you know. So he came from a family where it was fine to date people for 10 years. In fact, his brother had been dating his girlfriend for 10 years. So in there, you know, how he saw marriage, you know, he never really saw it growing up in his immediate family. And so he thinks that's normal to date someone for 5-10 years. That's normal. That's what he's used to versus what I'm used to. My expectations are I grew up with a mother and a father who've been married. They'll be married for almost 50 years.
Yeah.
So that's what I expect. So we just had two different expectations about what a long-term relationship looked like. And we never really had that grown-up conversation. It's uncomfortable. It's tough. We just dropped hints. And so I think that's what we did wrong.
So
I can't blame him all the way.
But, yeah. Was it 50? Yeah. So not really having the conversation about
We
marriage.
Avoided the conversation.
It was kind of like a teasing type of conversation. Yeah. Every now and then. Dropping hints, but not really sitting down and saying, this is what I'm looking for.
Right.
This is what I'm looking for, and comparing the two.
Right. And I think a lot of people in relationships do that. They say, oh, this is going to be so uncomfortable. I don't want to talk about it. But you have to. Just get out of the way. And on the other side, you're better informed either way, even if you're hearing something that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You get into some of the conversations had between you and your parents and your family in the book, and we'll talk about them a little bit later, but what was the response that they had about you writing about them in the book? Did you get permission ahead of time?
Oh,
or
no.
You just wrote it and then they were like, oh, what?
No. Thankfully, I don't know. I only asked 2 people for permission. But, you know, I come from a family of writers. My great-grandfather was a writer. My grandmother, my mom is a writer. So we write about each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is a preacher. She talked about me all the time. She still does on
payback.
The pulpit.
This was payback.
Yeah, so, you know, we're used to, like, you know, sharing our business, you know. Yes, we're used to it. And I think we all sort of have a level of respect for each other where it's like, I'm not going to say something truly embarrassing. So... Yeah. We write about each other all the time. So it was a little bit of payback, but in a good way.
Yeah.
It's all good things.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was. And not just family, but friends that are considered family. You talk about a special prayer that Auntie C tagged you in
on
a Facebook page. Now, the words covenant spouse lingered in your mind. Talk to us about who Auntie C is and about that Facebook page and that Facebook post and about those words that lingered in your mind.
Yes. So she's really my sister's godmother, but I consider her my godmother too.
Sure.
So Dr. Cecilia Williams Bryant, she's an amazing preacher. And so she had been posting these prayers on Facebook and she had tagged me in one of them randomly. And so I'm asleep, you know, waking up. The first thing you do is, you know, check social media. So I'm checking my social media and I'm like, she tagged me in a prayer. And the prayer said, I wish for you success and this and that. And I also wish for you a covenant spouse. Now, I had never really heard that term. You know, I'm churchy, but I'm not that churchy. So I was like, what is she talking about? So I had to, you know, go to my Googles and Google it and figure out what that term meant. And so after Googling, I was like, oh, wow, this is an amazing concept, because here I was, you know, desperate for a husband, who is only defined by his wife. But, you know, a covenant spouse is defined by his relationship with God. And I'm like, that is a type of relationship that I want, you know?
Mm.
Right. And I feel like that was the piece that I had been missing, sort of a God-centric relationship that allows you to have unconditional love, right? Because God loves you unconditionally. And I feel like if you have that example, then you're able to then say to yourself, yes, I can be loved unconditionally because God already loves me unconditionally. And I can then love someone else that way too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a missing piece of the puzzle.
That's really deep. I really hope people listen to what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
That's really deep. And a lot of people aren't realizing that. Like that, what you just said is not coming out of the mouths of millennials.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I hope that changes.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. So
yeah,
I'm so glad.
More of it.
I'm so glad that you're writing this, that you wrote this book. And I want people to pick it up.
Thank you.
Without giving the book away, I know. Without giving the book away, why was it important for you to name the book the title that it is, The Engagement Game, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage and I Do to Me.
Right. So I'll take the first part of the title first. So The Engagement Game, I really feel like it sometimes feels like a game, right? Like you're trying to figure out, am I good enough? Am I looking good enough? Am I doing the right things in order to secure a proposal? That is how I approach the engagement process. And that is a problem, right? Because the real person that you're supposed to be with, you don't have to do any sort of games or be any other person. You can just be and breathe. And that is who you're supposed to, you know, hopefully spend the rest of your life with. And the subtitle, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage and I Do to Me, honestly, I go back and forth whether that is how it truly captures what I really feel.
Okay.
Like if I could do it again, I may write it, you know, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage right now and I Do to Me, because oftentimes people are like, oh, why are you promoting, you know, not getting married? And I'm like, no, I want to get married,
right,
but I wasn't ready.
Read
you
the
know?
Book and understand.
Yeah, I wasn't ready. And so I feel like a lot of times when we are so, you know, thinking about getting engaged, we don't really turn the lens around and look at ourselves and say, are we actually ready to get married?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that after, you know, years of pressuring him to marry, I wasn't ready, you know? And so I had to say, I do to me and figure out what are the things that I need to do to become a better wife. And so, as I told you before, my sister suggested make a list of what I want in a husband. At the end of the book, I sort of make a list of the future wife that I wanted to be, you know, because the relation, you know,
I love that.
Yeah. You got to start with you first. And so I wrote things down like, you know, stop cursing. Because at the time I was so frustrated that it was coming out that I was cursing a lot more. I never really cursed that much, but I was so frustrated in my life. I was cursing. I wasn't smiling as much. You know, I wanted to be kind to strangers, those sort of things. And so I wrote down the list of things that I wanted to improve on my life. And then it sort of helped me cross that bridge.
That is so important. I don't know that I've made a list, but I know that there are definitely things where God shows me my heart. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This heart is ugly. Lord,
right.
Fix it.
Like, what do you want to
do
with that?
Like, seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so interesting when you say, you know, making the list for him and making the list for yourself, because it's important to know that not only are you precious, but he's precious to God.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And you have to... You know,
and you say it. You said that you in the book. You said that you asked God before you met Adam to give you a clean heart, to bear bitterness from your heart, so that you can accept what God has in store for you, and to lighten your path, so you wouldn't continue wasting time.
Exactly. And that is my prayer for breakups. I say it after every single breakup that I have, because you know, when you break up with somebody, it is tragic. And I was very heartbroken, but I did not want to carry that with me to the next relationship, because I knew I was going to get another relationship. Life is long and I'm still cute, you know, so, but I just, you know, had to get my life together, had to get my mind and my heart together. So I'm like, Lord, you know, please give me a clean heart. And that's one of my favorite hymns anyway. So I just, you know, had to get my heart together. So, yeah.
I love it. Where can we find out more about you? Where can we pick up this amazing book, The Engagement Game?
Yes.
How can we support you?
Yes. So all of my information is on joymarie.com. You can, and that's joimarie.com. My Twitter, my Instagram is all on there. And you can pick up The Engagement Game wherever books are sold. It's in Barnes & Noble, on Amazon, iBooks, Audible, if you like to listen to audiobooks. It's available everywhere. So please go support.
Yes. Producer and writer of ABC News and author of her new book, The Engagement Game, Why I Said I Don't to Marriage, I Do to Me, Joy Marie McKenzie, thank you so much for hanging out with us and joining us for First Edition.
Yes, thank you. This was great.
First Edition is a production of WEAA. The show is produced by executive producer Sean Yoes and associate producer Iori Odigizua. Our First Edition interns are Isaiah George, Wyman Jones, Alex Blanc, and Valentine Davis. Stay tuned for Wealthy Radio with Deborah Owens next, right here on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Stay blessed, Baltimore.